Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the Seymour Centre at the 2018 Festival.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Sydney Writers Festival for 2018. Whether this is your first or 52nd session, we're very glad to have you here on a windy afternoon in Sydney. My name is John Barron, and it's a pleasure to be with you for this discussion. We've got a great panel to talk about Trump's New World Order. I guess we could sort of subtitle this, how have we gone from Little Rocket Man and Fire and Fury to Donald Trump maybe being a Nobel Peace Prize laureate in 16 short months? But before we start, a couple of important messages. First, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land we're meeting on this afternoon, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. And on a more mundane note, can I ask you now to reach into your pocket, your handbag, and switch your mobile phone to silent? But you can leave it on silent, particularly if you have Twitter and you want to tweet along with the conversation using the hashtag Sydney Writers Festival. Now, a little later as well, we will have time to take some questions from you as well. So throughout the course of the conversation, have a bit of a think as to something you might like to ask specifically of one of our panellists. Often the best questions are the ones where, you know, somebody says something, you think, oh, I want to know more about that. So a specific question, have a really good idea as to who you want to maybe answer this question. It always works well. But now let me introduce our distinguished panellists this afternoon. From your left, my right, is Robert Kelly, the Professor at the Department of Political Sciences at Pusan National University in South Korea. To his right is Gorana Gergic, the lecturer at University of Sydney and the US Studies Centre, and Aaron Connolly is here as well, director of the Southeast Asia Project at the Lowy Institute. Would you please make them welcome? Now, let's begin, first of all, panellists, to each of you, on this notion, the title of the discussion, Trump's New World Order. Do you think, Robert Kelly, we can identify such a thing at this stage? And if so, as it takes shape, what are we seeing? How will we define that new world order?
Yeah, I'm actually pretty skeptical myself. It's not clear to me 15 months in that there's anything as coherent as a Trump doctrine. The administration did release a national security strategy in January, which was probably written by H.R. McMaster, who has since departed, and I'm not sure that the president even read it. It seems to have sort of came and went. And that should actually be the doctrine. I mean, that should be the answer to your question, and it doesn't really seem to be. The president doesn't seem to be following it. The president's sort of erratic kind of wild card psychology, I think, makes it difficult to track the president as he sort of swings from idea to idea, just like you said. You know, 6 months ago it was totally destroy North Korea, and now he's an honorable man and all that kind of stuff. So, no, I mean, the short answer is the president is winging it. I think his staff would like more coherence. But I mean, ultimately, you know, on foreign policy making in the United States is highly presidentialized, right? And so a lot of it falls to the president himself, and he is just all over the place.
Okay, so Gorana, even with that sort of lack of coherence and predictability and a challenge to existing alliances and treaties and so on, can we look around the world as it has existed in the last year or so and say, well, this is the world as it exists with Trump as president, and it is perhaps distinctly different from had 78,000 people in three swing states voted differently and Hillary Clinton had been president right now?
I think any president who would have come to office in January 2017 would have seen a world that's largely different to, say, the apex of American-led world, international world order, sorry, international liberal order in the 90s. So there's been a sense that the kind of liberal international order, as we know it, the kind of remnants from post-World War II era have been in a state of entropy. And that's because of the diffusion of power among the states, so the rise of regional challengers, of global powers, of the kind of rise of the great power politics, a diffusion of power away from the states, the fact now that we have these non-state actors, be they very powerful individuals or non-state actors or corporations that are challenging the system, and obviously the crisis of governance that we've seen and the lack of trust in institutions all around the world and most notably around Western democracies. Again, it's exemplified in US elections, but also in elections in Western Europe. So I think to answer that question then is not to ask whether there's a distinct new world order under Trump. It's more to ask the question of, are we seeing actually the remaking of world order? And I would say that the answer is definitely yes. And Donald Trump is just exacerbating or maybe aggravating the position the United States is in as that system owner or the guarantor.
Aaron, on Inauguration Day of 2017, Donald Trump famously said he is now going to put America first. America first. Has he been true to his word, or in Syria and North Korea and elsewhere, has he done as anyone would have done?
I think we tend to overestimate the president's influence on American foreign policy. We tend to do this in a number of contexts. But I think we particularly tend to do this with Donald Trump because he tweets these sort of outrageous things, and we assume that that is representative of American foreign policy. And I'm not here to say that the tweets aren't important, but U.S. foreign policy is complex machinery. It's like an aircraft carrier. If you don't know how to operate the aircraft carrier, it's very difficult to turn it around. And so Donald Trump is not someone who has actually thought about these issues very much until recently. It's not clear he thinks about them very much now either. He's not someone who has a lot of subject matter knowledge on these issues. And early on, the people he surrounded himself with were either people who, like him, had not thought a lot about these issues, or they were people who had very conventional views. And so despite what he said on Inauguration Day about putting America first and American carnage and all of that, the people he hired originally, McMaster, Mattis, Tillerson, had these very sort of conventional Republican views. And you can debate whether or not those are the right views for American foreign policy, if the second Bush administration was on the right track or not, but that's really where they were. What I think is different now in the last 6 weeks is now we finally have two foreign policy principals, cabinet members, who hold views that are not in the mainstream. It's not entirely clear that they hold Trumpian views. John Bolton is very hawkish. It's not clear that Donald Trump is quite as hawkish as Bolton is. But now you have Bolton and Pompeo, who are not really in the mainstream of the Republican foreign policy community, and they may do something different over time. So we may begin to see an America First foreign policy emerge.
Bob Kelly, let's talk about those two crucial roles and how they relate specifically to the ongoing attempt at a peace process on the Korean Peninsula. Given that Mike Pompeo was formally sworn in the last 48 hours and he is considered to be generally hawkish, John Bolton, as national security advisor, was pretty much too hawkish for the Bush administration in the early 2000s. Never met a war he didn't like, John Bolton. Does this change the equation now? Does this go from Donald Trump being the madman in the madman theory to Bolton and Pompeo?
Yeah, I think it raises the likelihood that the United States will strike North Korea in the second half of this year if the summit goes badly. The working assumption is that, I think, in the media, is that this summit is going to lead to some kind of breakthrough. I think that's highly unlikely, actually, because the strategic and ideological divisions between the U.S. and the DPRK are so wide, and it strikes me as unlikely those can be bridged in 9 weeks. My sense is the summit will be a bust, or there'll be some small beer stuff that's not really relevant. And then my concern is the president walks out of there and says, you know, I had this meeting with him, what's going on? Why isn't he giving us denuclearization? The North Koreans are supposed to go to zero. They're not gonna, because they spent 40 years developing these things, right? So now what do we do? And there's Bolton standing there saying, told you this was gonna happen, Mr. President. That's why we have to hit them, right? That's my concern. If this thing doesn't go well, or if it goes badly, if Kim and Trump start exchanging insults like last year, Orange Man and Dotard and Rocket Man, I mean, if it really goes badly, which it could, right? I mean, Donald Trump is very unpredictable, right? I mean, you guys have seen those videos of him, you know, he goes up there and he talks about whatever and he's screaming into the phone. If that Trump shows up and the summit just is a mess, then it's my concern is that's when the hawks step in and say, okay, look, you tried summit diplomacy, we're at the end of the road, there's nothing left, you met with him, and he lied to you and he spun you and he flim-flammed you, and so now we have to hit them. That's where the war cabinet comes in, after the summit fails.
What? There's a lot in there to unpack.
Well, we don't have a lot of time.
So before we talk about World War III later this year, can we talk about right now, as of this moment, what just explain for us how we got to this point from the bullhorn diplomacy conducted largely on Twitter, the maximum pressure campaign, and now the kind of the detente between the two Koreas that led to the joint team at the Olympics. Right. The meeting we saw just 1 week ago between the two Korean leaders, the hugs, the romantic walks in the woods and so on. And now talk of denuclearization And even the Pentagon considering the possibility of the withdrawal of 28,000 US troops as being maybe a part of a deal that could be done. How did we get to this point, particularly from Kim Jong-un's point of view? Why would he do this after spending, you know, 60 years with a North Korean nuclear program getting to this point?
Right. I think the North Koreans now have the ability to strike the continental United States with an intercontinental ballistic missile with a nuclear weapon on top. That gives the North Koreans deterrence, nuclear deterrence against the United States, and will prevent the United States from launching a regime change attack in the vein of 2003 against Iraq, against North Korea. The North Koreans now have that shield. The Americans are not going to exchange LA for Seoul, right? We're not going to, the United States is not going to tolerate a nuclear strike on one of its cities, right? So we're probably not going to attack North Korea and provoke that. Therefore, the North Koreans can come forward and begin to deal and negotiate and bargain. I think it's sort of the, it's incorrect to suggest that it's outside either pressure from the Trump administration or President Moon in South Korea, his solicitousness and engagement attitude. I think both of those sort of underestimate or overestimate how much influence we outsiders have on North Korea. I think the North Koreans, if there's any state in the world that makes decisions based on its own internal logic, it's North Korea, right? I mean, they murdered that guy in the airport in Kuala Lumpur a couple of years ago, the VX gas. And they just don't follow global norms. So my sense is it's not our pressure. They've chosen to come forward. They're coming to this from a position of strength, not weakness. They have the ability to strike the United States, and now they're looking for a deal, right? So that's why they're coming forward, because now they've got it, and they want to see if they can shop it around. And if we don't give them anything, they'll just go back to the defensive crouch they've been in for years and wait for the global community to adjust to their nuclear program.
Gorana, throughout history, there have been a lot of peace processes that have had seemingly intractable issues at the end. The question of, you know, sovereignty over Jerusalem, for instance. So in the case of the Koreas, arguably the issue of denuclearization and reunification, being these things that are talked about, but maybe ultimately impossible, therefore the process is going to come up against a roadblock at some point. Is that how you see it, or do you think the way that these processes work with the kind of pragmatism that we're seeing so far, maybe there's an opening here?
Well, I think that some of the developments are symptomatic, or so far have been symptomatic of Donald Trump completely deprioritizing and sidelining diplomacy so far, right? And then now, all of a sudden, the opportunity that arose, I think, is largely owing to the South Koreans setting the agenda and the administration using this now to basically kind of tag along and use it, maybe also because of the pressures from within the administration, because as long as Donald Trump keeps on talking to Kim and stops, you know, with all these insults of little rocket men, the lower the chances are that he will go down the fire and fury path. So in that sense, whether there is a kind of coherent strategy behind this, we are all pressed to find it. I think that there is certainly a conflation of different factors that have come from the outside rather than just this concerted and a very well thought through process on the US side.
You talk there about the deprioritization of diplomacy, sort of a diplomatic way of putting it. They've cut the budget from the State Department, not filled a bunch of pretty important roles, including, say, ambassador to South Korea, although they've now taken the Harry Harris, who's coming to Australia, to hastily fill that. How much does that matter, the fact that Trump has boosted funding for the military, cut funding for diplomacy? Is that more than just a statement of priorities? Does it actually affect the way that America has been conducting its affairs in the last year?
Well, it's very problematic when you have the kind of national security strategy proclaiming that it's all about principled realism, right? And this is what the kind of more conventional Republicans from within the administration wanted to make it into a coherent set of principles that would be more restrained in using American power, but still very strong on actually building up the military to act as a deterrent and all that. But what we've seen is actually some of these impulses that come from Donald Trump, and also the way that you have the chaos of actually implementing policy. You've seen the buildup, the militarism is quite muscular, but it's very aloof, right? You see once a year bombs are being dropped in Syria, right? But there's no strategy behind it, right? You have a surge in Afghanistan, but Trump never talks about what is actually the point in sending those troops there all about. You see the moral transactionalism and deprioritization of diplomacy, but you don't see any sort of sense of international community working together. You see these bilateral relationships. You see the complete disowning of America standing for any values that it does proclaim in that national security strategy, but obviously there's a lot of daylight between that and Donald Trump's tweets. So all of these impulses are not amounting to anything really coherent in the end. And that's one of the problems now that in teaching, say, US foreign policy, where before we had this sort of narrative of, well, democracies are great because they signal things well, they're very transparent, it's easy to deal with them. We actually don't know. We are here now discussing what the arguable leader of the free world, even though President Macron is now really vying for that title, as you've seen. You know, we are debating what are his thoughts. Will he or won't he? Will that summit go ahead? If it does, will it end up with bloody noses, or will it end up with a more peaceful Korean Peninsula? Will he pull out of the Iran deal? Won't he? What are the repercussions? Are we seeing the World War III anytime soon, or is it really a Nobel Peace Prize for Donald Trump? And then, you know,
hey, you're running through all my questions.
We'll all resign. So I'll stop here. But yeah, it's a kind of if there is any strategy, it's very, you know, kind of selective. It's uncertain, and it's being driven with by some of these impulses that come from different sides and ends of the administration and from president's personal credo.
Now, Aaron, on the question of the Iran nuclear deal, that comes up for recertification next week. And President Trump, as well as Secretary Pompeo, have certainly indicated they're not disposed to do that, but they have done it so far a couple of times since Trump was sworn in. Do you think now is going to be the time, particularly given that John Bolton is also on the scene, that we are going to see the Iran nuclear deal torn up? And if so, is it a real tear-up, or is it sort of like the other tear-ups of, you know, Paris Climate Treaty, TPP, et cetera? Yeah, we tear up this bit of paper with Obama's name on the bottom, but then we kind of, you know, redraft it essentially pretty much the same, and we now put Trump's signature on it.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that's been the question all along with Trump. He clearly wants to rebuke Obama, at least in symbolic terms. And the people around him have sought to allow him to do that, but then also make sure that by doing that, he doesn't blow up these deals. So, you know, the United States can't leave Paris until just toward the end of Donald Trump's term.
A few days out from the election, I think.
Exactly, yeah. But he can declare that he's going to leave Paris, and that gives him the boost domestically that he wants. And so it's a domestic politics, a domestic political boost for him. On the Iran deal, I don't know, because we have these new foreign policy principles in the administration. John Bolton, who's a longtime opponent of the Iran deal, it's not exactly clear why. But I think on this, I would just mention that when we talk about sort of the adults in the room, when we talk about people like Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, who has a pretty conservative instincts on the Korean Peninsula, he does not have conservative instincts on Iran. And so some of these people who have these conventional Republican foreign policy views in the administration, who've been sort of holding things together, they're more interested in a confrontation with Iran than some of their counterparts might have otherwise
been. Is
that
because of the traditional very strong Republican fealty to Israel, or are there wider considerations behind that?
With Jim Mattis in particular, it is because he saw in Iraq Iran as an enemy, because they were sending weapons and IEDs and money over the border to kill American Marines. And he feels, I think, very personally about that. And so a number of people who have had private conversations with him about his foreign policy priorities, Iran comes up as number one. So I would not be surprised if they don't prevent Trump from ripping up the Iran deal. The question is what comes after it, and what can the United States really do, and what would Iran's response be? Because the Iran deal was not just the United States. It was also the other five countries who were involved in the deal, the other four members, permanent members of the UN Security Council, and Germany. And their sanctions have still been removed. So it's not, and the reason that the United States was working with those countries to begin with to craft the Iran deal is because we knew that unilateral sanctions wouldn't be that effective. And so the question is, what do these European countries do if the U.S. does rip up the Iran deal? And can the United States really put pressure back on Iran by itself?
Robert Kelly, we had the spectacle of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu earlier this week with a kind of quite retro-looking PowerPoint presentation talking about how in the early 2000s that Iranian nuclear energy program they kept saying they had was really a nuclear weapons program. So the whole agreement from 2015 was built on a lie. Therefore, it should be torn up now, despite the fact that the head of his own armed forces says, you know what, it's working. The other five nations say, yep, it's working. Can Trump really afford to tear this up, particularly as he's also trying to do a nuclear deal with North Korea?
Yeah, and that's the linkage that I worry about a lot, right? I mean, the nuclear deal with North Korea is already going to be hard enough, right? And now if we walk away from Iran, that's just going to... I mean, if you're the North Koreans, the Americans walk away from Iran, right? And they're striking Syria, which doesn't have nuclear weapons, but they're talking to you because you do have nuclear weapons. I mean, you're sending signal after signal. I mean, you watch the president on Twitter, and he says this, and he says that, and he's screaming on the phone on Fox. I mean, they're not dumb, right? I mean, they can see all this just as much as we can, and then you sort of assume that they're going to think that anything that Donald Trump agrees to is really not what he'll stick with, or he might throw it out the window if he doesn't like it or something like that. I mean, the United States is not signaling that we're a very credible bargaining partner, right? And so if I were the North Koreans, I would stick to vagaries, right? I certainly wouldn't go to zero, right? You remember that we promised Muammar Gaddafi when he went to zero that he would be left alone, and in 2011 we helped the Arab Spring revolutionaries overthrow him. We did stab him in the back. I mean, not that Gaddafi didn't deserve to be thrown out of power, but I mean, we did bail on that deal, right? And if you're in the, I mean, so there's just multiple signals. You know, the United States has a credibility problem also, right? And so I that's one of the reasons why I'm so skeptical that a deal is possible, because I would be astonished if the North Koreans see all these signals and nonetheless agree. And if Iran goes out the window, then yeah, I mean, it just makes it that much harder. It's a very high hill to climb.
Well, let's talk about World War III then.
Wow, okay.
Starting in a number of places, because I think there are a few contenders, but when it comes to, you're talking earlier about the potential for, if it happens, and right. President Trump's indicated it could happen in as few as 3 weeks, in his comments this week, but if it happens in the next couple of months, how real is the danger that it could go from being a kind of just a photo opportunity to going rapidly downhill into kind of taunts and belligerency and possibly some kind of military exchange, if not nuclear conflagration, at least a bunch of rockets suddenly raining down on Seoul?
Yeah, whoa. And that's really the big concern I have about the summit, right? Because it's happening so fast that the possibility that it's going to be a stalemate is great. I mean, it's hard to imagine that President Trump can take an issue that's been bubbling for 35, 40 years and wrap it up in such a short period of time. So I think we have to prepare ourselves for the likelihood that it's going to be a bust. It won't be horrible unless Trump really flips out, which is possible, right? So it's probably just going to be a bust. It's just going to be a stalemate, in which case we're kind of back to where we were 6 months ago, and then the president basically has a strategic choice. Do we want to adapt to North Korea with nuclear weapons, or do we want to pursue some kind of confrontational strategy? And my own sense is that the president has kind of talked himself into a corner because of what he said last year, right? And I have the feeling that the Trump people are going to sort of ramp up the rhetoric when we're back to where we were with fire and fury and stuff like that. I don't know if we're going to strike. I'm really unsure about that, but I would say the chances of that are much higher than they were in the past. I think my own sense is we don't need to. My own sense is we can, I don't know if we want to go down this route, but my own sense is we can actually learn to adapt to North Korea with nuclear weapons. We adapted to Pakistan with nuclear weapons. I mean, you guys may remember, like, when Pakistan got a nuclear weapon in the late 1990s, everybody kind of freaked out, right? I mean, they got, like, an Islamic fundamentalism problem, and it's a weak state, badly administered, and people are like, oh my God, there's going to be a nuclear war in South Asia, and it didn't happen. And after a while, everybody got exhausted talking about it, and we all just kind of adapted to Pakistan with nuclear weapons, and no one talks about it anymore. If you're the North Koreans, this is probably your route. If the summit fails, you just dig into that defensive crouch, you hold, you wait for the storm to blow over until everybody accepts the fact that you're a de facto nuclear power, and we all just drop it out of exhaustion in the next few years. It'll take longer than with Pakistan because it's North Korea, which is a scarier place, but in principle, the only alternative to that is like a major conflict, right? Now, I would argue that there are other things we can do, missile defense and stuff like that, sanctions. I actually believe that the sanctions track, the China track, missile defense, those are all robust options that have kind of been thrown aside, I think, unfairly in the last 6 months. But, you know, Trump doesn't have the staying power, I think, and the focus for sort of a medium-term strategy like sanctions. I mean, he wants some kind of answer now, and if that's the case, then strikes are that.
Can you explain to us what is going on with China? Because on the one hand, it seems President Trump has coerced President Xi into enforcing a bunch of sanctions to really tighten the screws on North Korea that has helped us to get to this point. But at the same time, of course, he's embarking on a trade war with China. I mean, is this just the kind of, push-me-pull-you relationship that Trump has with, you know, reporters, family members, lawyers, and China?
Yeah, I think the president deserves credit for putting the focus onto China. I think, so here I will defend President Trump. I think the president was unfairly maligned for pushing North Korea onto China, dumping it on China, suggesting China might fix it. My thinking is that, yes, the route to Pyongyang goes through Beijing. North Korea is very dependent on China for access to the global economy. Something like 90% of China's trade or North Korea's trade goes through China. North Korean money is moved through Chinese banks. A lot of North Korea's illicit earnings are laundered through Chinese banks. And so you need China's grudging complicity, right? The Chinese don't really like North Korea very much, but they don't want North Korea to implode, right? We know that. They've told us that a lot. Right? And so China is the key. If you can get China to sort of shut the gate, I mean, really close the gate on sanctions, then North Korea really is in trouble, because then they have nowhere else to get cash and oil particularly, right? And that's why I do think the president deserves credit. But to be fair, I mean, lots and lots of people have argued for years that the China route is the way to go.
So, you say that China doesn't really like North Korea. How do they view them? Is North Korea kind of their deadbeat brother with gun collection?
I mean, yeah. That's right. A good way to put it. Okay. No, I mean, Chinese. When you go to the conferences, the Chinese scholars refer to North Korea as a buffer, right? That is to say that North Korea is a buffer between them and the robust democracies of South Korea, Japan, and the United States. I mean, this is very morally dubious, because you're instrumentalizing the pain and suffering of 23 million people who live in the world's worst gulag slave state. And I've seen South Koreans walk out of the room when Chinese say this, because it really is instrumentalizing the suffering of North Koreans for China's strategic interests. It genuinely is horrific, and the Chinese shouldn't say it, but that's where they are, right? And so what we need to do is convince the Chinese they don't need North Korea anymore. I mean, China's almost a superpower, right? I mean, they'll be bigger in GDP than the Americans within a decade or so. They don't actually need North Korea much anymore for strategic security. It's not the 1950s. So they could actually, in my sense is, whenever I go on like Chinese TV and I go to China and stuff, I'm always like, you know, you can cut North Korea loose. You don't actually need it that much anymore, right? But they like it because it distracts the Americans from the East China Sea and the South China Sea, where the Chinese are also pushing and making trouble, right? You Australians know that, right? Your Navy's going to get sucked into the South China Sea pretty soon. I mean, you know, the Chinese like North Korea because it keeps the Americans off balance and talking about 25 different things, and so it's useful for them. But just remember, it's useful, but it's horrific that it's useful, and they talk about it that way, right? I mean, it's a gulag slave state. It's the worst country on the planet, right? It's worse than, like, Amnesty International always says North Korea is, like, worse than Taliban in Afghanistan.
And you're saying it, then you're from Cleveland, so this is a pretty extraordinary thing to say.
I appreciate that.
I love Cleveland, I really do. Grant, I want to ask you about another nation and Trump's relationship to what is either America's greatest strategic adversary or indeed his best friend, Russia. How has Donald Trump's presidency impacted upon Russia? Is Vladimir Putin, we don't know the extent to which he colluded with the Trump campaign, but we do know he interfered with the 2016 election, and he put his thumb very firmly on the scale for the Trump campaign. But we also understand that he probably didn't expect to get Trump elected. How do you think, 16 months in, he's feeling about their measure of success there?
Well, yeah, as we speak, Vladimir Putin is somewhere shining his shoes. He's going to have an inauguration just next week, so coming in for the fourth term as the president.
Six more years,
yeah. So, yeah, he's seen now four different American presidents. You're absolutely right to say that they weren't expecting Donald Trump to win. I think all of the kind of interference in U.S. election has been done under the assumption we're just going to create a bit of mess and make Americans more divided and make it more unruly for President Hillary when she comes in. And, you know, when Donald Trump is now saying that he was absolutely sure, there are a lot of accounts to say that he was equally surprised. So one thing that for sure has thrown Russia Russia kind of off is the fact that now there's been this whole series of sanctions that have been passed, not because Donald Trump wanted it, but because actually the Congress and parts of the bureaucracy in the United States are very concerned about Russia's actions. So what we've seen is a rare show of bipartisanship last year, actually, the Congress passing a Russia sanctions bill that Donald Trump had to sign with his nose closed, but still passed. They have been relatively effective, and just the latest round of sanctions that have been passed in concert with European states over the nerve agent attack on Sergei Skripal in UK, they have started creating trouble domestically for Vladimir Putin, so much so that he does have now the oligarchs kind of panting kind of behind his neck, and this is where he could be very vulnerable. So the game that Vladimir Putin has been playing over the past couple of years has been, well, when you can't draw legitimacy from economy, then you just resort to nationalism, right? And then you cause a stir in the near abroad, like Ukraine, or go a bit to Syria, show how you can flex your muscles, how great the military is and all that, make people deflect from the domestic troubles. But now, not just that the everyday Russians are feeling the pinch, it's also the wealthiest supporters of Vladimir Putin. And now he's seriously considering what is he going to do with the economy coming into.
Well, what is he going to do? Because you look at Vladimir Putin's history back to the collapse of the Soviet Union, and he was a KGB colonel, staring down an angry mob that maybe was about to kill him, whether it was then or his reaction to the protests in 2011 at the time of the rigged parliamentary elections that sort of seeded his hatred of Hillary Clinton for her criticisms of Russia's form of democracy at the time. A little bit like Donald Trump, when he's backed into a corner, he bluffs and then he comes out swinging. What might he do next?
Well, he's not stupid, for sure. I mean, he's a czar of opportunism, I think, and he knows when to use these openings abroad and to gain incremental gains and then back off. And, for him, if there's a frozen conflict in Ukraine, and by the way, that's one of the unreported stories, the fact that we've had this war now going on in eastern Ukraine, right, in Donbas, that has claimed over 10,000 lives, right, the most on European territory since the Balkan Wars, actually. He's going to be pretty happy as long as Ukraine is basically a divided state, a failed state almost, unable to join any Euro-Atlantic alliance or anything like that. He's also going to be happy if Assad remains in power, which, if it remains the kind of peace process that's being negotiated now with Russia, Turkey, and Iran, it seems more than likely, right? He's going to be pretty happy with that. And now he's probably going to turn to start looking at the economy at home. And there have been some early signals that actually he's not very opposed to hiring some people that have been more, say, not pro-Western per se, but pro-reform. And there have been some early signals that he might even have a representative for international economic cooperation, which means a person that will try to work with the West to see the easing of the sanctions, because that, together with the falling oil and gas prices, has been detrimental for Russian economy.
So, Aaron, one of the big questions in American national security circles for the last 3 years has been, what is this thing with Trump and Russia? Why is it that he sees Vladimir Putin, who, according to the likes of John McCain, is a murderer, Hillary Clinton is a soulless thug, he sees somebody and says, that's my kind of tough guy leader. There's something I like about that guy. Do you think now, I mean, we don't know what Bob Mueller is going to come up with, but are we yet to get a kind of an understanding as to why Trump has been kind of weak on NATO, strong on Russia?
I think Vladimir Putin genuinely is Trump's kind of guy, because it's not just Putin, it's also people like Hun Sen in Cambodia. Donald Trump appears enamored with strongmen, and the theory is he'd like to be one himself. When Xi Jinping eliminated term limits, earlier this year on the presidency in China, his response was, yeah, we might consider that someday. And I don't think he's serious about these things, but I think in his head, these tough guys are a lot stronger than democratic leaders who have to compromise. And he doesn't like that he has to compromise, so he looks at Putin and he says, this guy knows how to run things. And it's sort of characteristic of a kind of machismo that you find occasionally on the American right that is usually tempered by an understanding of the history and the reason that we say these things about autocratic leaders and where it tends to lead societies. Donald Trump just doesn't have that history to temper his sort of appreciation for that kind of machismo.
We've tended to see Donald Trump as being more a kind of Silvio Berlusconi character than somebody perhaps, you know, with more sort of totalitarian tendencies. And yet we are seeing these figures, Erdogan in Turkey, elsewhere, we are seeing kind of, you know, established leaders really entrenching their power. Is that going to be one of the legacies of Trump's approach, even if he himself never does that, he's term limited, he's gone, or he's forced to resign, or whatever happens to him, but that he has somehow empowered this style of leadership, this intimidation of rivals, this manipulation of the media, possibly even this undermining of the democratic process, to sort of normalize that in a way that wasn't normal before?
Absolutely, but I think it's also worth recognizing that this was a trend that was taking place well before Donald Trump became president. In some respects, he's a symptom of that trend, as opposed to someone who is accelerating it. But I think there is a problem here in that the United States traditionally has stood, with exceptions, and sometimes we don't always get it right, traditionally has stood for democracy and liberalism in countries like Turkey. And the United States isn't really doing that anymore. It might still do that at the working level. There's still human rights dialogues that take place at the middle levels of the State Department and foreign ministries. But there's not that sort of leadership level push to free political prisoners, to make sure that elections are free and fair. Mm-hmm. And that is probably accelerating this slide toward illiberalism that was already taking place before Trump.
Do you think, for all his talk of isolationism and we got to stop picking up the tab for other people's defense and everything else, given that Donald Trump is increasing military spending, at some point he's going to want to use it, and he's going to want to use it in a less limited way than maybe 50 cruise missiles in Syria. He's going to want a Trump war that he can win and have his own May Day parade at the end of it.
I don't think so, actually. I think Trump recognizes that one thing that could really wreck his re-election chances is an economic crisis. And the surest way to get to an economic crisis would be World War III, right? So limited strike.
But if you time a war right, just before the election, wag the dog, it does tend to pay off. Wartime presidents get re-elected, don't they?
Yeah, potentially. But I think that Donald Trump has actually been pretty skittish about the use of the military, like Guarana says. It's been cruise missile strikes in Syria. It's been this sort of standoff strikes that we saw during the Clinton administration and the use of drones, as we saw during the Obama administration. There's some real continuity there. And the other bit of this is just, I don't think Donald Trump, he doesn't sort of aspire to the use of the military in that sort of violent way. He seems to aspire to it in a more symbolic way. He wanted a military parade in downtown D.C. Right. After he went to the Bastille Day parade in France and said, why don't we do these here?
And he wanted the uniform at the military academy, but he didn't want to go to Vietnam.
Exactly.
So he likes the look of it.
Yeah, yeah. This is sort of, it's a product of his upbringing where he went to this military school, and which was run by this sort of abusive martinet. And I don't want to get too sort of inner psychology in Donald Trump, but I think there's something there. And just in terms of military spending, he has proposed an increase, but it's not actually been as much of an increase as Republicans in Congress and around him wanted. It was only an increase of about 3% last year.
He just likes upsetting John McCain. I think that's what it
is. And John McCain was upset because John McCain wanted an increase of something like 18%. So it actually hasn't been, he's not been putting as much money into the military as Republicans wanted.
So, Bob Kelly, obviously Korea grabs the headlines, as does Iran, as does Russia, as does Syria to an extent. But there's a whole other world out there, some of which America is involved in proxy conflicts, like in Yemen. Elsewhere, we're seeing America kind of quietly, it seems, vacating the playing field. What is your sort of 30,000-foot perspective on America's role in the world at the moment? Are we seeing that shift yet, even if it's not yet a new world order?
I actually think that the liberal architecture is a little bit more enduring, in part because it's not clear to me what would take its place. I think right now everybody's sort of in a holding pattern waiting to see if Donald Trump actually is a sort of fly-by-night, flash-in-the-pan kind of thing, or is he really remaking American politics? Is he really remaking the Republican Party? You know, is the Republican Party going to look like the National Front by the time that Donald Trump is done with it? Is Donald Trump going to get reelected? You know, if there's the blue wave in the fall, you know, I think in a year we're going to look back when the president's under, you know, investigation and possibly leading to impeachment, we're going to say everybody got a little bit carried away. So I'm actually a little bit skeptical of this idea that Donald Trump is turning everything upside down. It's sort of like at the 30,000 foot level, just because he's new and he's sort of all over the place. He's so erratic that my sense is that the president is, so like the working level, like you were talking about, is kind of disjoined from him. That a lot of things are just kind of like operating on autopilot, waiting to see if this is actually a real thing that's going to get rooted in or not. If the president survives the fall, if the president gets reelected, if the Republican Party really does get reoriented as like an ethno-nationalist whites party or something like that, then that will actually really begin to seriously feed through into America's relationship with the rest of the world. But my sense is right now, you're not having that revolution because everybody's on hold, and the alternatives are actually pretty poor. I mean, nobody really wants to line up with China because it's like about to get even more autocratic than it already is, right? The European Union is kind of a mess. Right, what are your other choices? Russia? I mean, it's like a gangster dictatorship. I mean, there's not, I mean, the choices out there aren't great. It would be nice if the European Union functioned a lot better. I'm actually all for European integration. I worked for the German government on this issue many years ago. I'd love to see the European Union actually function as a genuine, integrated, liberal hegemon, you know, and like pull the United States in the right direction. But the EU just isn't there. It's just not, right? I mean, the United States is still the center of the system for better or for worse. It's still an English language system. It's still a dollar-denominated system and everything else. And so I'm still waiting before we sort of pass judgment on the idea that Donald Trump has flipped everything over. I just don't think the president has the lucidity and focus and attention span, to be blunt, to actually do that. I just don't. I think it's more sort of like the bull in the china shop for the sheer sake of being disruptive, and it's fun, and he gets to be on TV, and people are talking about him. I don't see a plan. I just don't. So, you know, in 4 years, if a normal Democrat wins the presidency, my sense, like an Obama kind of Clintonian Democrat, my sense is we'll probably be talking about repairing these relationships and putting them back together, and we'll see Trump as kind of like a one-off thing.
So you don't see an inevitable sort of reordering of the post-World War II order, that America will retain that role that it has had for all that time, even though its economic primacy is about right to be challenged?
Possibly in Asia, if China can find a way to market itself as not mean and awful and belligerent, right? I mean, the Chinese have got to learn soft power, and soft power doesn't mean just buying their exports. It means the Chinese have to learn how to be more pleasant and congenial and get along with their neighbors better, right? Bullying them, right? I mean, you guys know this, right? South Koreans know this. I mean, bullying the neighbors is not a way to, you know, sort of like build long-term hegemony, right? So if the Chinese can do that, then you might actually have some kind of like meaningful Sinic space, a Monroe Doctrine or something in East Asia. But in Europe and Latin America, I can't see that. Russia's way too weak, and you know, Western Hemisphere has been peaceful for many, many years. So China's the only real competitor, and the Chinese are sort of, it's not clear to me that the Chinese actually want to make this bid, right? That we're actually sort of like going straight towards a conflict. I don't know. I mean, maybe you guys think otherwise, but it's not clear to me that the Chinese have sort of actually decided, yeah, okay, we're going to challenge the Americans point to point. I don't quite see that yet.
Yeah, I mean, in the sort of sweep of history, Grana, there is a view that says that China is maybe content to stay in that little sweet spot that the US was in before the First World War.
Yeah, that's right.
Number one economy, who cares, military, we're just happy to sit back and get rich.
I think I would agree definitely with what Bob has been saying about maybe the future of liberal international order. If we just see one term, Trump would be kind of just resuscitating what's there and not needing to really redesign everything in a great manner and overhaul it in that way. China has certainly been free riding on a lot of these issues. It's very unwilling to contribute to any sort of peacekeeping for obvious reasons, but you know, in these sort of global governance issues, or I mean, it has been maybe more visible as of late in more humanitarian ways, but not certainly to an extent that we could actually claim it to be that full responsible stakeholder, what has been the term describing the expectations around China's rise. But I would be a bit more skeptical about where the world is actually moving moving, and what we've been seeing. I don't think that everyone is just sitting out and waiting for, is this going to pass? Are we going to see midterms come with a blue wave where Trump is going to be embroiled in impeachment for the next 2 years? I think we can't underestimate the symbolism of American presidency. And even what Aaron has been saying, on a working level, you know, you have diplomats who are there, who have been there as career officials, going to different places around the world and restating America's commitment to liberal norms and values and democracy. But then all of these leaders, all of these populations around the world only need to log into Twitter or turn on the TV and see the very latest strand that President Trump has said, the way that he has actually legitimized far-right groups, the way that, you know, when he retweets these videos that far-right groups in UK produce and that are absolute, you know, junk news, but still, when they are getting legitimacy from the highest office in the world, it does create damage. And I think one of the big questions will be around what happens on this, you know, the rhetorical level still matters, because you might have substantively things not moving too much in a kind of wrong direction. But if one side of that equation is not as committed and is not willing to, do what it's supposed to, what the expectations have been, then the repercussions are much greater than we would expect.
Now, we've got a few minutes to take some questions from you as well. So we've got some roving mics. So if you've got a question ready, just raise your hand and we'll get a mic to you. But while we're waiting for that, Aaron, can I ask you, we've heard about what Republican Senator Bob Corker referred to as the adult daycare centre around Donald Trump. The head of that daycare centre, or one of them, H.R. McMaster, is now gone. But are we seeing the international community, through the sort of glad-handing of Emmanuel Macron, stepping into that role now, really trying to coerce the president into sticking to the Iran agreement, maybe not to bow out of Paris, all these kinds of things? Is he being managed in that way?
I think certainly people are trying, and I think we owe Macron a debt of gratitude. I mean, the obvious domestic, politically popular domestic politics thing to do in France would have been to snub Donald Trump. But instead, as soon as he was inaugurated, he was inviting him to the Bastille Day parade, because he recognized that Donald Trump loves pomp and circumstance, loves to be the center of attention, and that he would appreciate this. And as a result, established a relationship. And so it's up to leaders to sort of swallow their pride and their instincts and perhaps their disgust at Donald Trump, and to seek to have a relationship with him where they, you know, can sort of flatter him and convince him to do things. Because if democratic leaders don't do that, if people like Malcolm Turnbull, like Emmanuel Macron, Theresa May don't do that, certainly people like Xi Jinping will, and people like Vladimir Putin will. And that's not the voices that we want in Donald Trump's ear. We often say that the most important advisor to Donald Trump is whoever spoke to him last. And so it's important that we get our reps in from democracies, and that it's not people like Xi Jinping who have the last word with him.
It's a very interesting thought. Well, let's get some questions from you. Over here.
James Comey has said that Trump is unsuited morally to be the president, and we look at the fact that he lies a lot and that his personal life is less than admirable. Do you think the United States' standing is permanently compromised by the moral position of the president?
Do you want to say that one, Garana?
Yes. No, absolutely. I would go back to that whole idea of the symbolism of American presidency. I think that a lot of people around the world look to the American president as that spokesperson for what the U.S. stands for. And at the moment, it is basically deemed that the United States can't be relied on or trusted in the same way that, you know, it was trusted or looked upon when Barack Obama was the president. And you can only take a look at the international public opinion surveys that have shown this rapid and huge decline in just international public support for the U.S. president, where in Europe you had 70 percentage point drop in basically these assessments, whether the international publics would have confidence in the U.S. president to do the right thing or whether he is actually suited for that office. So I don't think it goes, you know, those sort of, that sort of sentiment spills over into policymaking, and this is something that certainly foreign policy elites also know. So speaking of some of the allies and their behavior, you know, there has been a lot of kind of calculations on part of some of these allies. If you take a look at what Macron has been doing vis-a-vis Trump and then what Theresa May has been doing, Macron can do that with, even though French people aren't super enthusiastic about Donald Trump, but Theresa May, for instance, can't, just because of the difference in the political system, where she would get really slammed into parliament. And obviously we've heard a lot about Trump's impending state visit, which has been demoted as just a random visit where he parachutes in and out, apparently, and all that. So yeah, absolutely.
Do you think, Bob, that the American president is an important part of American soft power, or given that past American presidents have been murderers, crooks, and drunks, we get over it after 4 or 8 years.
Really? Okay, I'm not sure if I agree with that last statement, but okay. Sure, I mean, we've had...
Andrew Jackson, had sort of... Richard Nixon, and Richard Nixon.
Okay. So we've had less than stellar presidents. I said it before, is that we have to wait to see if this is a really locked-in thing. If Trump can revolutionize the Republican Party, if the blue wave, the resistance, whatever you want to call it, if that materializes in the fall, then that suggests, my sense is that will suggest that the Americans kind of like lost their mind for a little while and then kind of like refound it, and you get a kind of recentering, right? If that, and we just don't know if that's going to happen. We just don't know. I mean, the Democrats are running pretty substantially ahead of the Republicans now in the generic congressional ballot. So if you get that and the Democrats can retake the presidency, my sense is you have sort of like this weird moment and the ship gets righted. And given the centrality of the United States to the current architecture that exists and the very poor alternatives, right? I mean, remember, this is always a relative game, right? And it's not, the choice is not sort of the United States or sort of like this system that works great. It's the United States or whatever else is out there, right? And as long as the alternatives to the United States are poor, there's a kind of default to the Americans, which we're coasting on. I mean, I get it. There's a lot of inertia that's carrying us through this period. But 2 years is probably enough. It's only 2 years, right? I mean, we have actually made it this far without the Cuban Missile Crisis in Korea, right? So if we can just hang on another couple of months, we can get through this. But if it doesn't happen, if Trump really does turn the Republican Party into the National Front, which is my genuine concern, then people will be like, we're just not going to line up with a party that is, you know, occasionally winning the presidency, that's openly the alt-right, flirting with Nazis and the rest of it. I mean, this is the big test in the next couple of years, right? Is the Republican Party going to hold the line, or is it going to slip into this alt-right whatever is out there, right? And it's not clear to me that Trump is coherent enough to actually represent all of that, right? I mean, the real question for Trump, I think, is the next guy who comes after him, who's much more coherent and focused, who has the Trump values but is actually, like, really a demagogue, right? Trump is too incoherent and too much of a mess to be Mussolini. The real question is, who comes after him? Does he pick up those threads and actually really craft it into, like, some kind of... So if that doesn't happen, then...
We'll wait to see how President Kanye West pans out, I guess. Well, with that, we are out of time. Would you please thank our panellists, Aaron Connolly, Grana Gergic, and Robert Kelly. And thanks to all of you for attending the Sydney Writers' Festival 2018. I'm John Barron. Thank you so much.